Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. We're talking about the future of the classical music industry with some great guests. Thank you for joining us.
Hello and welcome to Music Works, a podcast by Polyphony Arts. I'm Katie Beardsworth and today we're joined by Margaret Pinder. Hello, Margaret.
Hello there.
And Ben Cooper. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. We're going to do today slightly differently in that Margaret is going to take the chair and lead us in a conversation. Would you like to tell the audience what we're talking about today, Margaret?
Yes, what we're talking about is a very exciting report that Ben, our guest, has authored for the Fabian Society. Ben's a researcher with the Fabian Society, which is a think tank, a UK think tank. And earlier when we were doing live broadcasts during lockdown, we had a couple of really great sessions with Ben about another report he authored earlier called Primary Colours, which is about the importance of arts in primary schools. And we spoke to Ben and a couple of teachers and had a couple of really great discussions off the back of that. Well, this is Ben's brand new report, which has only just been published very recently, and it's called Cultured Communities. So I think this is the point which I should hand over to you, Ben. I should add that Katie and I were slightly involved in this, actually, because within the report looks as examples at two places that were sort of marked out for cultural events, Hull City of Culture, and that's when Katie and I were involved. We were actually involved in a round table that's mentioned in the report, so we feel a special connection to this.
Probably not as much as Ben does.
Probably not as much as Ben, the author. Yes, we're sort of, Ben's sort of the proud parent, and yeah. You know, we're just standing there going, yes, oh, I sewed that pretty hanky that's hanging out the pocket. So Ben, maybe would you like to just talk a bit, introduce the report and explain the thinking behind it and the structure and some of the content and why it is so incredibly important now.
Absolutely. So this report looks at arts spending by a various numbers of bodies, but largely local government. But it actually comes out of a question as to why local arts and culture is so important for communities. And we focused on four main areas, which are supporting the local economy, transforming local communities, improving well-being, and increasing social mobility. And across all of those four different themes, it really shows how transformational funding arts and culture, both in activities and in the sense of the buildings and the venues, are for communities and places right across England. So this is an England report, because arts and culture funding and local government is devolved, so it's slightly different across all four regions of our United Kingdom. And it really says that if you want to transform your local community, your place, you have to invest in arts and culture. That's one of the ways you can do it along those four things. So it can create jobs, both directly but also supporting our creative industries, which I'm sure will come on to in a second, and attract tourism. At the moment, we can't really travel anywhere, certainly not internationally, but pre-COVID, arts and culture were absolutely a massive draw for tourists. On transforming local economies, our high streets in particular, which are a source of great pride for a lot of people, but also because of the challenges facing the high street, is a source of a great challenge. And actually, arts and culture can be a solution to many of the empty shops that we're seeing, the collapse of the big well-known high street brands and restaurants, and can offer a more local offer to people who live there. And then we've also got increasing social mobility. That's really about education. You mentioned Primary Colours, of course, and it very much feeds on much of that work that said if you want to give opportunity to young people across England, then you really need to invest in arts and culture, because that can help them at school, but also later on in life when it comes to the workforce and the job market. And then improving well-being. You know, COVID shown a lot of the challenges that we face in well-being, particularly around mental health and loneliness. and arts and culture can really be a solution to that by bringing people together, ensuring that no one is left out, and that it tackles isolation and loneliness, but also in the sense of physical and mental health can also prove a solution. So it really seeks to tie up a lot of the things that people know about the benefits of arts and culture into one report, and present the case for building back better, is a very popular phrase at the moment we're in policy making world, that if you want to build back better, if you want to help places across England, then one of the things that you need to do is invest in arts and culture. But that hasn't been done, and hasn't been done for some time, and I'm sure we'll touch on that in a second now.
Yes, I think that's right. I think this is why this report is so interesting, because I think, Katie, you and I find that when we're dealing with artists and venues and festivals, they're at the end when the feeling is very much that we're the poor relation, and that arts and culture is seen as a kind of luxury bolt on to other essential services. And I think this report does a fantastic job in looking at just why the arts are so essential to us as a society. So I think that would be a really good place to start, actually, is to look at, I mean, you've mentioned the economic benefits. I think you said it, I think there's a figure there of something like 111 billion value to the economy in 2018. So obviously, if that's lost, it's really important to get that back. That, you know, as artists, we shouldn't be, our musicians, our artists shouldn't be feeling that they're constantly there with their hands out for funding because they're on the receiving end, that the arts actually contribute a huge amount. So, Katie, I wonder what your view is on, you know, the feeling that artists need to feel, that musicians, artists need to feel that actually, you know, they're a really important part of the economy in terms from the point of view of what they contribute.
Yeah, I think that is a really important point, because on this podcast, I've been had lots of discussions about the way artists feel about themselves and their work and the value that's attributed to that by themselves or by the industry and so on and so forth. And in reading this report, it's led me to think more about the context going back in history a bit, obviously, than dealing with, you know, we're very in the immediate situation, which, as the report points out, the arts funding cuts have been going on since 2010, which is obviously 10 years. That's been most of my professional career I've spent in this, the way things are at the moment, or the way things approximately are at the moment. So I can see that where we are now is that essentially the art doesn't feel valued, or the artists don't feel valued, especially, well, certainly I can speak for the musical world when I say that. It's a challenge, fees are a challenge, support is a challenge, things like, you know, creating environments to work where which are conducive to people who need things like childcare, or, you know, have lives that need them to do things other than just be an artist, pure and simple, as most people do in some form or another. So, you know, I think it's important, this is a really important contextual part of why artists feel undervalued. It's not just because they're artists, it's because actually, you know, essentially what is funded, a huge amount of where we feel value comes from. I didn't put that very well. You know, what the government shows what it values by what it funds. And as much as we don't always agree with the government, or we may actively disagree with them, that's still there. And anyone who's operating in that industry still has to operate in that sphere. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. So, Ben, maybe you'd like to talk a bit more about the economic aspects of the report. Because that's also tied in with well-being, because, you know, there are direct economic benefits that you've elucidated, which are obviously, you know, stimulating the economy. But also the arts in terms of improving educational outcomes and social cohesion, and also mental health and well-being. You've got some very interesting stuff in there about actually how that you can actually show direct economic benefits there as well.
So I said there were four things. They're actually deeply connected. You know, if you improve well-being, people are more productive. You know, they're they can help grow the economy. If you improve your high street and make it attractive to a really good, strong cultural offer, you improve your economy. If you obviously make sure that your workforce is well trained and has access to the highest possible educational opportunities to grow the economy, and vice versa, you know, if the economy is strong, therefore people, young people find it easier to learn because their parents are probably having a higher wage and are not in poverty, same with the high streets, same with wellbeing, but specifically on the economy. So it's £111 billion, you said, for the creative industries. It employs 2 million people. It's a significant number of people. It's in 2018, it grew 5 times faster than the economy itself. So that's just 3 statistics as to how important the creative industries are. But arts and culture funding, public arts and culture funding, underpins the success of the creative industry. You can't have a vibrant creative industry sector without also having a vibrant arts and culture sector that's supported by the public purse. So, and Hull is a great example of that. You know, Hull has, until COVID, I know there were serious challenges for the Hull economy, but Hull used UK City of Culture incredibly well to create a new homegrown set of creative industries that really were going to thrive. Now, we don't know what the impact of COVID is going to be, but had it not happened, Hull would have had one of the most vibrant creative industry sectors England had. And I think that's really important when you look in the future as well. So the government is committed to levelling up. It wants to close the gap between particularly northern towns and rural villages, you know, areas in the north, and London in the southeast. Now, usually levelling up has been seen as hard hats, railways, big buildings, fancy buildings, you know, but actually it's so much more than that. If you really want to level up, you need to invest in arts and culture for the 4 reasons that I've mentioned. Because if you want to ensure that people in the north have the same educational opportunities as people in the south, invest in arts and culture. If you want to ensure that their high streets are as strong, perhaps as those are in the south and London, although COVID accepting, we all know that the challenges that London are facing with the high street, then you have to invest in arts and culture. If you want to grow the economy and make sure that it's strong as the one in London in the southeast, invest in arts and culture. And you know, I can go on so many times. It's one of the things that you need to do. You know, it's not just about your railways. It's not just about your big fancy building. It's about doing the basic stuff right and making sure that the funding is there and available, and then people will really benefit from it.
Yeah, I mean, Katie, don't you think? I was really startled by the statistics actually on the disparity in funding across the nation.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's felt as though it's been a focus for some time to make the funding less London centric. So I was surprised to hear that those are still the figures. I can't remember if you mentioned them earlier, Ben. Do you want to tell us what the general picture is again there in case?
Sure. So specifically on the Arts Council England funding, we can come on to the council funding, which is just devastating right across England, including London. But specifically on the Arts and Arts Council England funding, there are 2 main streams. You've got your national portfolio organisations, which are typically seen as your national treasures, your big organisations, and Arts Council England provides a pot of money over a number of years, guaranteed stream of funding. Now, because it favours the larger organisations, it also favours London. And per person, organisations in London receive 3.7 times as much, so nearly 4 times as much, as places and organisations outside of London. Yeah. That's been well known. That's been where Arts Council, I think it was Arts Council Great Britain, recognised that was unfair and potentially a problem in 1984, so 40 years ago roughly, and it's not changed that much. But the real problem, the one that we focus a lot specifically on our recommendation, because there are arguments about why national portfolio funding should be so unequal due to the distribution of the national treasures, but the national lottery funding itself focuses on the community arts, the grassroots arts, the arts that is in every village, in every town, in every city, in every neighbourhood. And it's paid for by people who purchase their national lottery ticket. But the thing is, it's not in any way equal distribution. It's better than the national portfolio distribution. It's only about 2 times as much per person in London compared to the rest of England. But however, when you consider that it's about the arts that is in every place, the funding isn't particularly fair, and it really does have, you know, it causes problematic effects outside of London when, you know, an organisation that works with young children, that, you know, does stuff with the migrant community, that works to improve inclusion and diversity within the sector, isn't funded because of this lack of equal distribution, and it means that places outside of London really do miss out on necessary funding.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
So obviously what we're seeing now is that so we've got a situation where we've got everybody in the arts was well aware of that the arts were actually becoming increasingly fragile before COVID anyway.
Yeah.
And then we're seeing, so, I mean, if you'd like to talk through a bit about the cuts, because you did mention the cuts. I mean, there were the cuts in the arts funding and then the local funding, because as you say, there are different aspects to arts funding. There's the actual Arts Council, but then of course there's the local funding. And they've really taken a beating, haven't they?
Absolutely. So for a very long time, before there was an Arts Council England, before there was a Department for Culture, local councils were the most important funder of arts and culture. And they've maintained that position right through to today, and they still are, despite the significant cuts. But since 2010, since 2009-10, councils now spend annually £860 million less a year. Now that works out at roughly £18.60 per man, woman and child in England. It's a significant sum of money. It's about roughly 40%, 38%. And that is, you know, it's been completely devastating, particularly for the libraries, which do have their role in actually supporting arts and culture, not just in the sense of accessing books, which we know to be arts and culture and particularly important for education, but they also, you know, host galleries, they can provide support for the creative industries. But you've also got your arts development, that's taken another significant above average hit on the budget. So it has been devastating. There's no way of trying to dress it up. It's been devastating. Yeah. And it's particularly been devastating outside of London because of the unequal distribution of Arts Council England funding. So in many places, often local government was the only funder of arts and culture, or the only significant funder of arts and culture. But it's not anymore because of the austerity that the central government has implemented. I don't think that a lot of councils wanted to cut the arts budgets in the way that they have, but they've been forced to because they lack the money to invest in it properly because of what central government's done. And you can see regionally the impact has been often in places that are, when it comes to per person amount rather than percentage, in the poorest areas. And the areas that actually could benefit the most from arts and culture investment. But as I say, there's no way of avoiding it. The cut since 2009-10 for local government funding of arts and culture has been truly devastating for the sector. And it's created that fragility that we all know about and that you've mentioned.
I think I'm just interested as well to think, and I'm aware that you have a report that's full of statistics and research, and I just have ideas. But I was, I'm struck by the period of time we're talking about, being from 2010 to now, the changes that have happened in what's needed to make art happen as well. Because in that time, I mean, when I first started my career in 2010, arts organisations didn't have digital media, social media experts, or didn't need them, or were only just starting to need them. And over that time, they've become an absolutely essential part of promoting and making sure that culture and art is known about has been that, and to the extent that when lockdown happened, in some cases, the only person that wasn't on furlough was the social media person or the person updating the website to say, you know, this is still happening, and this is what we're doing in the meantime. And it's just, I wonder if, as well as the depreciation in funding overall, the amount of money that can actually go to art creators might have decreased even further, because there's money that's having to be diverted into people who manage these things that, you know, they are now essential, and they're also highly skilled, kind of digital marketing and digital type roles, you know, to move with the times. Do you think?
That's actually really interesting, if I just may, because there has been, because public funding is retreated and there's been less of it, that's meant that there's more private funding has been has stepped in and has become the thing that a lot of organisations have relied on. And that's probably the social media person is probably the one that is contributing and raising the awareness of that organisation in a way that can either get greater ticket sales, if that's what the organisation does, or charitable donations from rich people, basically. There's no way of getting around that. But that shift from public to private has created the fragility that COVID has brutally exploited, because ultimately when there's a pandemic and we're all locked inside and we can't associate and go to these venues, no one's buying tickets and people are probably not donating. So I think that social media person could very well be emblematic of a wider change in how funding is allocated and who relies on what funding. But they do a fantastic job, absolutely right, but is it a symbol of something that's actually perhaps more devastating for the arts and culture sector?
Yeah, because you do touch on that actually about how the shift towards private funding. So with the cuts in government, local, central and local government funding and Arts Council funding, is that there's a reliance on organisations have had to be, so venues particularly, have had to become more innovative and self-reliant. So they've done really well. You know, they've got cafes, they've got all sorts of ways within the venues to actually create income, which of course they've now, COVID has now cut that, so you know that they're actually almost being punished for being so innovative. But also when you're looking at relying on philanthropy to fund to sort of make up shortfall, then you've got a discrepancy, because London's the richest part of the country, and if you're seeing serious cuts in impoverished parts of the country, and that councils that traditionally spent in impoverished areas, in poorer parts of the country that were actually supportive of the arts, are now struggling even to provide the most basic, you know, things they absolutely have to, social care. And there's less wealth there. So the ability to kind of call on private philanthropy, also that there's a regional imbalance there.
Mm. Yes, so when you look at all three streams, councils, Arts Council England, ticket sales, but also philanthropy, they all favour London, particularly the private investment and the ticket sales, because that's where the bigger institutions are, as I mentioned, and they find it to be most attractive to invest in there. But it has consequences. You know, a pound of private investment isn't necessarily the same as a pound a public investment, and it has particular consequences for access. You know, there's a lot of evidence that's shown over the past few years that ticket prices, particularly in London, have increased dramatically. And that means that a person from a poorer background, a poorer family, can't access this arts and culture because there isn't the public funding that could potentially keep prices down, because you know they don't have to make it up for the ticket sales. But it also has an impact on the artists themselves. Let's not pretend that it doesn't. And one of the things I'm interested in, you're both artists yourselves, have you seen from your work what has been the impact over the past few years in the impact that this shift could potentially have had on those who work in the sector?
Well, that's definitely one for you, Katie. I mean, we could both talk about it, but you know,
Actually,
that's.
yeah, that's I'm glad you asked that because I've just been pondering all of this from the perspective of one of the arts organisations that I work for, and I was wondering whether to say, shall we look at the impact of this with that sort of case study in mind, because this is essentially what we're talking about is the impact. This report is shining a huge light on the impact of the funding situation on, or certainly to my brain because of the people who I work with, grassroots and the next generation of audiences and creators, musicians and their. Or artists, but you know, in our context, musicians and their work at the moment, and music organisations who might rely on this funding or not. And so I was thinking of Whole Chamber Music, which is a chamber music society, obviously based in Hull, as the name suggests. And it's a model that's quite common in the UK. It's a local chamber music society which puts on brilliant concerts of visiting artists. Who come and do one-off performances 6 times a year, and it's over 70 years old, and it has recently, in the last 5 years or so, become desperately important that we raise money for it to keep it going. And this has never really been needed before. It has had funding before, and especially from the local council, but not to the same extent. And the things that have happened that have caused that, I think, are very common in other organisations as well. The audience numbers are dwindling because the people who are interested in coming or who we're presenting concerts, who feel like they're the right audience for the concerts we're presenting, are getting older and becoming unable to go to concerts and so on. And the younger people aren't being, essentially aren't becoming interested in it. The people that run it's always been run by a voluntary committee for, you know, whatever, 68 of those 70 years. And suddenly that became untenable because it needed professional people to run it in a paid capacity. It still has a board of trustees, but because of the need for website updates, for digital media, for social media, for strategic planning, for fundraising, it became impossible to get people who had the time and ability to volunteer those skills. And so that combination of things, and this is obviously a huge topic, but that combination of things results in that organisation needing funding where it didn't really before. And essentially, that's down to, I feel I'm at risk of going on a tangent, which isn't where I intended. But what that there are lots of reasons for things that, you know, there's a whole audience development side of this, which could basically address the first point. But what's relevant here is I think that the simultaneous reduction in funding and perhaps reduction as well in education or like popularization of classical music as an art form, and therefore the reduction in audience numbers leads to organizations not being able to sustain themselves in the way they have before. Does that make sense? Should gather my thoughts there for a
No, I think so. That's right. There's sort of, you know,
like, yeah,
demands
so two
on
things are happening at the same time.
organizations.
Yeah.
Demands are increasing and expanding in their range and variety, just as funding is reducing, and that's becoming hugely problematic. I think
So,
one, yeah, sorry,
oh,
Katie, go
sorry,
on.
there was one last thing, which is that the other thing that's happening with the funding's shifting to be more reliant on individual philanthropists because public funding is less available. Is it that the, I mean, this is also true of public funds, but what exactly they will fund depends very much on the funder. So you end up picking through and saying, right, if we want actual artist fees, we have to go here. But if we want core costs, if we want to pay staff, if we want to pay for design or a new website or something, we have to go here. And that's not necessarily a problem in itself, but it does mean that there isn't doesn't feel, as somebody who works for an organization like that there's somebody looking at the overview of how these things run and saying, this is what you need. And obviously there are funders that do that, but then you're in the competitive market. Do you see what I mean? So it's like the, you know, having to pick through the variant, you know, not looking at what the sector actually needs and saying, right.
Yeah, because there is a tendency with private funding that they're going to want to fund, in effect, the sexy bits.
Yeah, exactly.
So a funder's going to say, yes, I want to put my name to, you know, having Sheku Kanna Mason come and play a concert, rather than I'm going to fund a digital marketer, I'm just going to pay your running costs for a year. You know, that's actually vital, but it's more capricious than government funding. So I think, so we can see the pressures on there. Let's just look at Hull, because that's a really great example as to the difference the arts can make in a bigger picture, in a bigger picture setting, because Katie, you and I were both in Hull for the City of Culture, involved in events, and experienced that whole, you know, that whole year of extraordinary events, and that was underpinned by a real philosophy of social benefit, that actually the city would come out of it stronger, more vibrant, more socially, more economically vibrant. And it did happen, didn't it, Ben? I mean, you know, there was a fantastic atmosphere in the city. But again, coming back to one other thing I love about the report is that it's absolutely crammed full of statistics. And I really love that because, you know, you and I, Katie, as people involved in the arts, we want to say we know it's a good thing. We can see it's a good thing. But it's great to be able to point to something and go, and that shows why. So, yeah, so there was Hull and Waltham Forest, but do talk a bit about Hull because obviously that's closer to our hearts.
Yes,
no, not that we don't love Waltham Forest.
No,
yeah, Waltham Forest, we love you, but let's talk about Hull. Yeah.
I mean, I should actually say a lot of... So Waltham Forest was London Borough of Culture 2019, so it was a smaller event. It was paid for by the Mayor of London, London Assembly. But actually many of the themes, many of the benefits, many of the challenges were similar across the two. But I do love to talk about Hull, so, and I think it's absolutely right that we do focus on Hull. And I think
yes, if we didn't mention, Ben's also a Hull boy, so, you know, yes. we've got a bit of a local team going to bat in the in Music Works to this week, yes.
And all three of us know that Hull's got a long arts and culture pedigree, long before... you know, we got City of Culture, but actually I think City of Culture proved that culture is for everybody. I think that's a really crucial thing. The statistics on actual, the numbers of people who participated in at least one event were pretty much the entire Hull and East Riding population, but also the types of things that people participated in. So I'm sure all three of us remember Made in Hull, which was the first week with the light installations that are against many of our grandest buildings in Hull. And the thing about that was it was for everybody. It kind of felt like everybody was in Victoria Square or near the Deep or, you know, watching many of the fantastic illumination. But there was a real sense of community. There was a real sense of people coming together, watching art. But also it told the story of Hull. I think it told the story of Hull in a way that many people didn't realise, the things that the city has to be proud of, you know, its contribution throughout history, the famous people, its contribution to music, of course. And it really, you know, people of Hull were proud before the event happened. But I think, and in fact, we did a focus group with a number of people from Hull, and it said it gave them permission to be proud in their own city. And I think that's really important, because Hull has and arguably still has a reputation of not being a very good place. The people who live there know that it's absolutely nonsense, but it actually transformed not only people's pride in the city, but also people's approaches to the city from outside. You know, we got put on the weather map. You know, something like that was simply transformation, I think, for Hull. You know, it was definitely a...
It literally puts us on the map.
It stopped everyone going, Hull, yeah, it's up near...
Where is it?
Yeah, and it's amazing, you know. I mean, yeah, people don't always know where it is. I had never... Yeah. realised the importance of the weather map until that happened.
I know, and some sort of, but also, you know, education, you know, absolutely transformational. Hull was able to put arts education back into schools, and we've seen the results. I cited in the report one primary school who worked with Opera North, and I think a secondary school that did the same, and their results were simply transformed. And same with well-being and the volunteers. You know, the volunteers still are amazing. You know, they really did transformational things and really helpful things during COVID. But when you actually look at what they did during City of Culture, you know, what Hull did with the policy really was superb. But the problem was the policy. So there was significant problems and challenges that resulted out not of what Hull did, but because of the policy, and I touch on those. It's stuff like, for example, Hull got no central government funding, for it had to bid for funding and put up its own funding. Now Coventry has received funding for its City of Culture, but it did mean that there was that, you know, it put a cap on aspiration. It meant perhaps that they had to, you know, not necessarily do what they wanted. It also meant that they had to take it out of the council budget, but it also meant, particularly for the legacy, that it couldn't do as much as perhaps it wanted to. So in the focus group that we did, one person described it as a sugar rush. So, you know, you were going up to that fantastic year, the year happened, you ate a lot of sugar, you got really hyped, yes, wow, fantastic, this is amazing. 2018 rolled around, yes, there were some things, but if you look at what happened the year before, it wasn't comparable, and there were concerns as to how much had actually changed. So there's things around the funding. There's also, you and I were at the round table for there was comments about where the arts was located, largely in the city centre, which meant that particular problems, because of Hull's low wage structure, because of significant poverty in the city, it meant that someone on the outskirts simply couldn't get the bus journey into the centre to enjoy the art. Now, there was fantastic work done on the, you know, in the communities on the outskirts of Hull, you know, not just in the centre, but there wasn't the same level of stuff, and I think that really caused a challenge. And there were similar things in the Waltham Forest. Now, Waltham Forest is a borough, is much easier to get around. London generally is much easier to get around. They've had significantly higher transport investment, but that's for another podcast. But there were comments that even though, and I think during our primary colours discussion this came up, even though there was a very simple, relatively short tube journey from Waltham Forest into the centre, into, you know, go and see the Tate and other things like that, they weren't doing it. They weren't accessing the benefits of central London arts and culture. So that's another thing that yes, arts and culture can improve the economy and everything, but you also need to make sure that arts and culture is accessible through people's incomes. Class obviously has an implication, disability, race, gender, all those things really do need to be taken into account. But Hull showed that you can do it. So that's one thing that was really great. And obviously, you know, just very quickly on the street art, we all know the street art of, for example, Lillian Blocker. You know, they really are, it really is about pride in the city, that I think we should take from things like City of Culture and Borough of Culture.
Yes, I mean, I remember that. You see the light show at the beginning. I remember standing at Victoria Square. I was weeping. I was so moved to see the light show, that there was the history of Hull. You know, my family comes from Hull. They come from, you know, the very poor area on the Hazel Road. And there was an incredible, and people around, you know, we were all, there was this incredible sense that, you know, we were all sharing this extraordinary moment of witnessing our own culture and our own heritage and celebrating it, actually celebrating it, as opposed to, you know, always the kind of self-deprecating, humour about Hull. That actually, yes, this is fantastic. And I think the other thing that I agree with you about the accessibility, which I think we come to, but the thing I really thought that City of Culture got right was it said there is no hierarchy of culture. There is no high culture. There is no low culture. It's all good. It's all good. And that was very important, I think, for making it accessible. Because I think when it comes to people thinking about the arts and thinking about funding, there is still a tendency, coming back to your big portfolio organisations, of thinking the arts is affluent people putting on posh clothes, spending a lot of money, and going out in an evening into, you know, sit under crystal chandeliers and, you know, listen to the opera. Or, and of course, the kind of art that is transformational tends to be much more the grassroots stuff, the stuff that's happening locally, the stuff that local people can access, the kind of thing that gets to kids when they're in school, because we're talking about audience development and aging audiences. We need to take the arts into schools, A, to be building the artists and the audiences of the future. But also, as you said, there was the Opera North in those schools. The results were transformational. You can actually go, if you do this, you could don't go, well, we get a general sense of well-being and benefit. You go, if you do this, you will get a very clear benefit there. You can actually go directly from the arts experience to a direct benefit, especially for young people in the education, a direct benefit in the experience of the arts and an increase in well-being. And if you want to be economic about it, a reduction in demand on healthcare. I mean, I think one of the examples you had was, I think it was Gloucester, wasn't it?
Yes, yes. So they use arts and culture, arts on prescription. So it's basically an alternative to more medical procedures. And they've seen a significant reduction in expenditure on patient, but also improved care. So it really does, you know, it's both preventative in that it can prevent medical conditions, particularly mental health conditions, by, as I say, tackling loneliness, anxiety, but also can actually prove to help medical care when it happens, when something happens. So, you know, and you're absolutely right on the saving money or not spending more money in the long run. You know, if you can improve educational outcomes, that often reduces funding, you know, for other interventions later on down the line. And hopefully that's something that we can see out of UK City of Culture for whole. But obviously we're only 3 years on and it's going to be some time to see the benefits. And I suppose that's perhaps one of the challenges that arts and culture does have. Obviously we've got these statistics in the short term which are really good and really do bolster the case, but the long term benefits of arts and culture is so much more and actually really does prove the case. But often, you know, long term benefits is much harder to make the case for.
Yeah, because I think what we're looking at, now, Katie, which is sort of brings us, you know, to the point where we are now with this whole discussion, which is sort of what now? So here we are still in a COVID society that is really, really hammering the arts, especially the performing arts, just really absolutely devastating. But we can see, so we've just been talking about why the arts will matter going forward out of COVID. And there was a speech by Simon Clark, who was the then Minister for Regional Growth and Local Government. And they talked, and you mentioned it, Ben, the government talked about levelling up. It says, following COVID-19, the need to level up every part of our economy has clearly ever been so great. Well, there's got to be an argument there for the arts. You look at everything we've done. And you said yourself in the report, and I think, Katie, this is where you would pick up, I thought one sentence really jumped out at me. It was the cost of inaction is high. The cost of inaction is high. So, Katie, I wonder what, you know, your perspective on, you know, where we need to go in terms of that, because we're struggling with short term, but trying to kind of get sustainability and make the argument for the long term benefits. Because if we allow the arts to collapse in the short term, there isn't going to be a long term.
Exactly.
It just isn't.
Well, I think, you know, I think that the COVID crisis, as much as I, you know, think it's devastating in every way, pretty much, it does it has torn down or is in the process of tearing down some of the expectations in the arts world. It's shown where the problems are, which is essentially the reason why I started this podcast, is because there's so many discussions that need to be had about the future of classical music and the arts more widely. Because, you know, those of us who work in the arts have always known what the problems are or had inklings of them or experienced them really directly, but never has the sector felt them all at the same time, collectively, the way we do now. And, you know, I think that we need to, as a sector, do a really enormous piece of work on listening to and thinking about our audiences. And as much as I'm very artist focused and would always think about that and so on, the artists that are being successful at, speak to audiences, and the work that is successful speaks to audiences. And I think that funding will always be a part of the arts, because it's very expensive to put on things like operas and great big operatic orchestral performances and so on and so forth, and the market might not necessarily always work its way out. But essentially, what we're being faced with is a situation where the sector has to adapt or cease to exist. And I wanted to come back to my artist management perspective on City of Culture in Hull, because I think that I completely agree with everything you said, and I think it was a very successful year, and I was very involved in the whole thing from the moment it was announced, and all the skepticism that there was, and everyone saying it was only a label and it wouldn't make any difference, and then it did, and I really truly believe that it did. But what I noticed was that, so first of all, what you were saying about why it was so successful, because there was no high art, no low art, and it, you know, art is art, culture is culture, and it's all great. What that did was that made everyone feel part of it and everyone feel welcome. And we've touched on problems with disabilities and access and so on, which are all extremely real problems. Excuse me. But as well as those, there is just a simple fact that it doesn't matter how cheap or whatever something is, if people don't feel like it's for them, they just won't come. And it's our job as arts promoters to make people feel like this is their bag. It's their people. They're going to fit in. It's going to be a safe, welcoming, wonderful place to be. And the other thing that happened in City of Culture was they created this massive organization, or relatively in arts terms, massive organization that ran it. And one of the and they did loads of really, really great things, and it was brilliant. And one of the things that they did was they had a marketing machine for the entire city's stuff. And I worked for the University of Hull at the time, and Hull Chamber Music as well. And we had audiences like we've never seen in that year, and so did other arts organisations, and I know that. And then in subsequent years, they dropped again, and I'm sure that this is more complicated than just this one issue, but it went to me to show the importance of really well-trained, knowledgeable kind of marketing and audience development people being in place to support great culture, because basically that message that was going out there to the whole of Hull and the East Riding to say you're welcome at this, that was to do with the art, and it was to do with the way the art was presented by that team. So I think that's you know, it's like this sort of like moment in my arts career where there's been adequate marketing support for all of this stuff that's going on, and it's been and gone now. But I do think that a general understanding of the way the different levels of expertise and types of expertise that come into both creating and promoting the arts can kind of coexist more in a more understood way would be a really good thing for the future. As a quite a long-winded answer. But yeah, essentially, in terms of where we go from COVID, we have to go back to square one of saying, what do our audiences want? How can they consume it? How much can they pay for it? How much, you know, essentially is it worth? And be responsive to that. Because if either they don't want it, or they can't get to it, or they can't consume it, then it's not going to be able to be successful.
No, I think that's right. It's very true. It's the question that we wrestle with all the time. And you know, there's always a point at which, you know, it's like there are two types of problems. I always say that is it solved if you throw money at it or not? Well, you know, it's surprising how many can be solved if you throw money at them. And I think with the arts, it's a bit more subtle than that. In fact, I think it's a lot more subtle than that. So I think to round up this discussion, what I would like to look at, Ben, is not only did you do this report, there's all this terrific research, all these fantastic statistics, these wonderful case studies, this very wide-ranging look at, you know, social benefits, economic benefits, but you do make policy recommendations, and I think this is where this is what's hugely valuable. So I just would like, I think we should close, if you want to run through those policy recommendations that you make in the report, off the back of this discussion. Yeah, well, pick the ones that...
For all of them, they're part of a theme, and the theme is that if we want a vibrant arts and culture sector going forward post-COVID, then we need to allow councils to invest in arts and culture. They're the ones that have the knowledge of the local area, they're the ones that know how arts and culture can meet local needs and challenges. You know, they're the ones that can really maximise expenditure most effectively. So that's the starting point, and then there's a number of different things. So immediately, as we know, the government announced £1.6 billion of funding to effectively freeze the arts and culture sector until February 2021. Most of that money has been allocated, but there's still, the government says, £258 million that needs to be distributed. What we say is that needs to be done through a partnership of councils and Arts Council England to really marry up the Arts Council England knowledge and also the local council knowledge. Local councils weren't involved in any part of the distribution of the 1.6 billion that's been allocated. So what we're saying is that needs to change to really put local councils more to the forefront of those decisions. And then the going forward from that is, I mean, fundamentally, if we want councils to invest in arts and culture, we need to make sure that councils are funded well themselves. And that means an increased budget for local government. Also means changes to the way local government is financed. I'm not going to bore you with that, but basically they get yearly allocations. They don't know what the next year's allocation is going to be. That provides no certainty. That provides no stability. It can chop, it can change. And what we're saying is there needs to be more certainty, because arts and culture funding, as I previously mentioned, you know, it's about long-term change. Requires a long-term budget. It needs councils to be in there for the long haul. And we also want to encourage arts and culture investment. So we think the government should provide £500 million in a future arts resilience fund that really focuses on the fact that, you know, as I say, that the arts sector is incredibly vulnerable, that it was going to suffer some sort of shock. Obviously, none of us could have predicted COVID, but it was going to suffer from the vulnerabilities that, I mean, it already was, but it was going to turn deeply problematic. And we want to prevent that in the future. They should be sustainable. They should be secure. So that's an additional £500 million for that purpose. And then I'm probably not supposed to have favourites, but my favourite is what we want to do is provide another £500 million to local councils to purchase strategic high street properties. Often the big ones, the ones that would have been occupied by your department store, or perhaps like an old bank, that kind of, if you've got your vision, the vision of those kind of properties, to purchase them. It would be a grant, so they wouldn't have to repay anything, and put them for local culture use. And that means that we could have creative industries, we could have arts organisations on the high street providing benefits, you know, occupying previously empty high streets. And we could do it with affordable rent. So one of the big challenges for a lot of organisations, creative and non-creative, to be on the high street is the high cost of rent. And what we're saying is if we purchase high street properties, put them to social use, put them to the use of the community, that means we've got arts and culture on the high street, you know, being involved in people's daily lives. If they shop, it can be a source of well, when we're allowed out of the house after COVID, of interaction. It could be something that's really exciting, and it's a local offer. It ties into local identity. It's about pride and play, and I do think that's really exciting, really transformational. It could prove a lot of good. And then, since we touched on Arts Council England funding in the conversation, we say that they should be phased in the Arts Council England national lottery funding, not national portfolio organisations, but national lottery funding should be allocated on an equal per person basis over 10 years, if that's possible, to really ensure that funding is fair. Now, some people would say that means London loses out. I say that because if it's implemented with increased local government funding, actually London will see increased budgets as well. But it also means that we have a fairer allocation of national lottery funding, which ultimately is paid for by people who purchase high street, who purchase national lottery tickets on the high street for their benefit. And we also suggest that there should be a pilot of of it being devolved away from Arts Council England to local communities, to bodies that are sponsored by combined authorities. So combined authorities are local councils working together. They have a mayor. Andy Burnham is one that you may have seen on TV, they work together across Greater Manchester, for example, across the Liverpool City region, to allocate funding in a way that is best for them, because they obviously live in the community, they represent the community, they're best, in theory, placed to make those decisions. And what we're saying is that we should hand over the National Lottery funding on a pilot basis, and hopefully it'll work. And if it does work and it improves outcomes and improves access and improves the economy, then that is good, and it should be extended to all Metro Mayor combined authorities. So that there are other recommendations around procurement, around city of culture, in fact, making sure that Hull, the example of Hull not getting central government funding isn't repeated. There should be provided funding, particularly for legacy. Learning from Waltham Forest, we very briefly mentioned Waltham Forest. So the London Borough of Culture provides what are called cultural impact awards, which are basically saying that because only one borough can win the award, and there are 32 London boroughs, that means that only one can provide the benefit. But with cultural impact awards, they provide additional funding for events, for schemes that can provide benefits right across the city, and it makes sure that it would be for across England, and it ensures that places that aren't cities can benefit from the UK City of Culture scheme and award as a totally, so it means that rural places, villages, towns can bid for it. There's other things about procurement, around how can local government spend money most effectively, often learning from what the best councils do. But I encourage you to read the report and look at all seven recommendations, because it provides a lot more detail on how each of them would work.
Yeah, it is. I will say, yes, it is a terrific report. It's well worth read. You can find it on the Fabian's website. You can download it. You can order hard copy, but you can download it. It really is worthwhile. And I would also recommend Ben's Primary Colours report if you're interested in that. So I think there's a lot to take away from this. There's a lot that's worrying, but also there's a lot that's encouraging in that there are, it does hold a light up to us and show the arts that we are a hugely important sector, that we are important economically, socially, in terms of well-being, in terms of education, in terms of social mobility and closing attainment gaps. We are working in a really important field, and it deserves support. And I think what's coming out of this is the sense of, well, I mean, what are your takeaways from this, Katie? I'm thinking valuable but vulnerable, sustainability, fairness, devolution of funding. What would you say your
Yeah,
takeaways were?
absolutely. To me, as well as those things, there's a new level of understanding for me in terms of the way the landscape has shifted for people who are working in the sector. and providing either professional management or art itself. I find it very interesting to look at the ways in which things have shifted, and how, you know, as I say, those of us who are at the same career stage as me might have always existed in this kind of way of things, but those that have had longer careers that have gone on for more than the last 10 years will have experienced other ways of doing it. And, you know, I often think that in our society we lose the lessons of the past often. But you know, there is so much has changed, there's got to be a new future.
Well Ben, thank you so much for coming and talking to us, and thank you for the work you've done, because we think it's, you know, it is really important and really valuable that that it's put out there, and it's put out there in I say with supported by such great data.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I think we're looking forward when COVID ends, where we can actually, you know, all meet again in Victoria Square and celebrate, you know, Holland City of Culture, wouldn't that be good? Let's look forward to that.
Absolutely. Thank you so much to both of you for coming in and leading that discussion. It's been really fantastic. It's such an important topic, and just echo Margaret that the level of research and actual facts that you present us with is really so much needed. So thank you both very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Okay, I think we've done.
Yes. Right, don't go away though.
Yeah, no, don't go.
Thank you so much for listening today. To find out what we're up to, do join our mailing list or follow us on social media. And if you'd like to support the podcast by buying me a coffee, you can do that on buymeacoffee.com. Thank you so much. See you next time.